Welcome. It's good to be together. I want us to take a few moments to breathe together, and as we breathe together this morning, let's remember that we are breathing in the same breath of life as all of humanity. And if that feels too big, then too abstract, then remember that you are breathing in the same breath of life as me, as the person across the room from you, as the person across the street from you, as the person across some perceived cultural difference from you. That at the core of our humanity, there is something so common and so profound and so mysterious that if we ignore that, we've just missed something enormous. So let's breathe the breath of life together. Breathe however you want this morning. Ha! How about that? No direction this morning. Just breathe in and enjoy that you can do that and that we can do that together. And we'll do that for a minute or two, and then we'll carry on with exploring. All right? Let's breathe together. Peace, everybody. I would typically pause right here for a land acknowledgement. So I'm going to pause to acknowledge that this is where I would usually pause. I'm not going to expand on my gratitude that we are welcome on Treaty One territory as we live and love and share this week. I'm just going to leave it right there. Because I have something that I want to really connect with about it next week, and I'm going to consciously set it aside, not the issue or the acknowledgement, but the exploration of it, and jump right into the other things we're exploring this morning. So, last week at the end of our talky bit and sort of woven throughout, I posed a series of questions around a shared issue. And I framed it sort of this way. Is there anything we as humans can gather around that doesn't evaporate as soon as we define it? Or is there anything that we as humans could gather around that would not so easily be turned into yet another way of clobbering one another with I believe versus what you believe? Is there any story that is bigger than our personal preferences that we could hold in common in the 21st century North American and wider Western world. Maybe what we're looking for in this is a different image than hold in common. I must say that as I've sort of been working my way into this exploration myself, it feels sprawling, it feels important, and it feels sometimes very slippery. Very hard to kind of that bit of a greased watermelon exploration here. And so if you feel sometimes like I'm kind of zooming off here and then zooming off there, and that is a little bit how it feels to me too once in a while in all of this. Anyway, those kind of questions, is there a bigger story? Is there something we could hold in common in ways that are life-giving, that are freeing rather than constraining and combative? Those are the kind of questions that typically take me, first of all, into a consideration of the general terrain of the common good. What is good that we could hold in common? And that is part of the wider realm of moral philosophy, so as a discipline. Those kind of questions also take me into a realm of thinking about ideas and metaphors that is very different and has some real tension with the idea of common ground. And I'm going to explore that kind of contrasting set of ideas or approach and some of that tension next week. So just so you know, what I'm exploring this week is not, I mean, I hope we all know by now that I'm not trying to get to a last word on something when I'm exploring, and I don't feel like that's what our community is here to do. But every once in a while, the contrasts feel a little bit starker, and just to sort of set that up a bit next week, we'll feel like, whoa, that is a different way to look at this than the way we're looking at it this week. So it's not about saying this one has merit and that one doesn't. We're just putting them out there as part of the exploration. So I know we're just getting going, but I feel like we need to pause right here for something that could stop us before we really get rolling. Some of us, as soon as we heard the word moral, even in the phrase moral philosophy, as soon as we heard the word moral, we had an at best unpleasant internal sensation. Morality, morals, moralizing, all of those things have been given a pretty rough ride in our contemporary world, and I identify with that. That's resonant for me. Just that word morality is sometimes enough to put me in a defensive posture. Tim, you were making the point that time flies, and you know, we can reference historic things as though they were shared experiences and then realize they really weren't. I feel conscious that not everyone listening to this has had to live through the political and religious movement emerging, the movement called the Moral Majority, the birth of the religious right, particularly in America. But I did live through that, and the impact of it is carved deep enough into my psyche that it's not that easy to just buff out. So the word morality can just like back me up right from the beginning. But the interesting thing about that is I was sort of reflecting on why that is and how it felt inside of me. I was reminded that words can take on meaning in ways that can be quite fluid. And if we ever wonder about that, all we have to do is think for a moment about euphemisms. Euphemisms, by definition, are sort of everyday words or phrases that we use in ways that are meant to blunt the directness or skirt the directness of words that we might find too direct or even embarrassing or hard to use. And just ask anyone who's ever been, you know, been let go from a job, if that's what they thought was happening to them. What is the image that comes to your mind if you think of yourself or someone saying, I'm letting you go. I'm letting you go. Well, I'm letting you go definitely represents something, but probably not the experience of the person that is getting fired or terminated or downsized, retrenched, moved along. These days, the word morality is often shorthand for a bunch of things that at best we really don't like and quite possibly even deeply distrust. It's a word that in common parlance points toward things like the intrusion of impersonal standards into our private lives, things like the presence of judgment where judgment really doesn't belong, things like the substitution of authority for choice. Anyone who has ever been subjected to paternalistic moral directives in a structure of vertical authority knows what I'm describing here. Kind of that, when I was like, what's a phrase for this for me? The phrase that came to mind was, I don't care if you are the leader of an entire global religion. You don't get to tell me who I can or can't love. You don't get to tell me what I can or can't do with my body. And in fact, you don't get to tell the collective, the human collective, that either. Some of us, of course, have had this experience of vertical moral direction in ways that are quite literally too close to home. Some of us can remember being treated this way, personally, and some of us can recall treating others this way, where we've been the one holding the authority. So we're leery, you know, and it's understandable. When a politician moralizes, it's hard to not wonder what it is that they're trying to avoid paying for. When a religious leader moralizes, a lot of us find ourselves bracing for the imposition of certainties that we no longer share or of beliefs that we no longer hold, and then we find ourselves sort of internally keeping an eye on the horizon for the fundamentalism that we suspect is going to follow. Generally speaking, these days, in this culture, we might feel more at home with George Bernard Shaw's idea that morality is one person's way of disrupting someone else's innocent enjoyment. Here's a curious thing, though. If we explore the values of the author of that statement, with which we might find some resonance, we might find that we're more comfortable with that statement of theirs than we are with the historic fact that they affirmed dictators on both the right and left of the political spectrum. And we may find ourselves very uncomfortable if we were invited to weigh the question, how does Shaw define innocence? And does that definition have anything to do with the freedom they feel to affirm dictators? You know, complicated, right? And I'm not trying to be sneaky here, but when we do the work of thinking about those kinds of issues in our own lives or in our society's life, work, thought, all of that, when we do that kind of thinking, we are solidly in the terrain of what would typically be called moral consideration or moral philosophy. That's the kind of work we're doing. And so we might not like the word, and it might haul all kinds of distasteful, untrustworthy, or even dangerous freight in our experience, and yet moral thinking is something that we do all the time. We care, and we care a lot about things that are essentially moral. When we hold a belief or use a phrase like, that's just wrong about anything, we're hip deep in the moral swamp. We are doing moral thinking. We're holding a moral value. When we are disrupted in our own equilibrium by legal injustice, or when we're disturbed by seeing it elsewhere, when we see extreme economic inequality and we're disturbed by that, we're caring about something moral. When we repost our indignation at Jeff Bezos profiting from the pandemic while refusing to increase the slave labor wages of people in warehouses shoving things into boxes as fast as humanly possible, and we express that indignation in the same week that we ordered something, we're like in the thick of moral consideration. We are making choices based on sometimes slippery, evasive, changing, pliable, it seems, moral considerations and moral values. When we are distressed about environmental destruction in pursuit of endless economic growth, that's a moral question. As a parent, I am not indifferent to the suffering of others, including my own kids, that might be the outcome of my present choices. Thinking about something like that is thinking about morality. It's thinking about the difference between what is and what ought to be. Maybe that's a workable euphemism if we feel like morality has become too blunt or embarrassing or too frequently historically misapplied to use in everyday language, even our own internal everyday language. So maybe the difference between what is and what ought to be is a more approachable language for this. Perhaps. Anyway, when we hear the word morality, we might be disinclined to lean in for all sorts of valid reasons. And so, for the reasons that I've mentioned, for others that we'll explore as we go along, I'm going to use the language of common good sometimes. I'm not satisfied that it sums up either the topic or the problems, but it might serve to help us get underway. So every once in a while I'll go there. Now, common good. Good. Half of the phrase, the word good. Good, of course, points toward its morally contrasting not good. And it can be an easy setup, even a phrase like common good, because of that aspect of it, can be an easy setup for the symptom of societal disintegration that we talked about last week, which is polarization. It's an interesting thing. We don't have to hold any particular moral positions to see that polarization is wildly dysfunctional. Even if our highest or only value was pragmatism, the consideration of what works, what gets the job done, we would mostly find it easy to agree that polarization doesn't. It doesn't work. You can't even get things done in a polarized atmosphere. But even if we agreed about that, we seem to be having a pretty tough time figuring out what some of the alternatives might be. And maybe One of the reasons we're finding this challenging is because we're approaching the consideration of alternatives in the ways that we've been taught. And the ways that we've been taught, if we just look at the evidence right on the face of it, are exactly what has brought us to the place of being such a polarized, divided, and divisive society. So if we use the same tools that got us to a polarized state of present being to consider the question, what's the alternative to polarization? Where do we end up? We end up looking for the opposite of polarization. We end up looking for the polar opposite of the thing that isn't working, right? And so that's that's probably not going to work. Might be safe to speculate in that direction. Here's a question. What if we start from a different place? What if we start from the place that acknowledges, so this is in contravention to thinking of the world as a place of polarization. What if we start from a place that acknowledges that the world is complex, that it is multifaceted, that it is not fully knowable, and that it is profoundly relational? At its core, complex, multifaceted, not fully knowable, and profoundly, even essentially, relational. What if we start from a place that is something like, I know I don't know everything. Most of us could own that. I know I don't know everything. To which we could add something like, at least sometimes, but I want to know more. Some of which I can only learn from someone other than me. Different than me, some of which I can only learn from you. What if we start from a place that acknowledges that wherever we think we are at as a society, we didn't suddenly find ourselves here? We might have these moments in history where we name things like we've done with polarization and say, here's a word, here's a single word we're going to use to represent this enormous thing in our conversations. And we need words. They're the handles we grab onto when we're wrestling with things, right? But what if we acknowledge that we didn't get to this place suddenly and we're not going to leave it abruptly? This is not about the kind of thinking that is susceptible to quick fix applications. This is long curve stuff. One of the implications, at least in my mind, about that kind of perspective, those bigger, I'm going to say more generous, but also more confounding perspectives, is that we might find ourselves considering engaging in conversations or taking on projects because we perceive them to serve the common good, or because they are better than the alternatives, even though those conversations or projects don't come with any kind of guarantees. And even if we can clearly see that we may very well not live long enough as individuals to see some of the good outcomes of those conversations or projects, that we are working on something that requires more time than we are likely to be to enjoy in our life, in our lifespan. That can all sound super vague and theoretical, something that I sometimes do. So let me give you a couple of everyday examples of what I'm talking about. This first one might sound so prosaic as to not even belong in the category, but recycling. You know, right? Talk about, I'm going to rinse the can, I'm going to put it in the bin, I'm going to put the bin at the curb, right? I mean, that's about as concrete as it gets. Well, if that choice is connected to our consideration of something like the health of the planet, we did not get ourselves into this state of planetary dis-ease suddenly. The Anthropocene may be a relatively short chunk of human history, and it may be largely within that chunk of human history that we've done a vast percentage of the damage. But even with that in mind, we didn't get here abruptly. And we won't get out of here abruptly. So, rinse the can, put it in the bin, take the bin to the curb, is participating in something the results of which, the hoped for, worked for good results of which, are liable to be well beyond my lifetime, well beyond your lifetime. So what's good for me is not really the whole measuring stick for this, right? Loving someone, even when they aren't treating us in a loving way, that's that kind of project. That's the kind of thing we might choose with a longer view than just, how does this feel right now? Anyone who's ever been involved in trying to break the chain of generational dysfunction knows what I'm talking about here. Raising kids that care about others, maybe even more than they care about themselves, at least on occasion. That's complex, but it's also a valid example of this kind of thinking. Sharing the good things we have, whether that's something as measurable as wealth or as abstract as kindness, can fit into this way of thinking. Like I said last week, this is a big exploration with lots of moving parts, so many of these talky bits are not going to have a tidy wrap-up. This is me setting you up for this being one of those. I would say of this exploration and many of them in where I imagine this might go, that if life is a highway, we're going to spend a fair bit of time on the on-ramp with some of this stuff. One of the distinctions that I sometimes find helpful when I'm thinking about the best way forward in a given situation is to think about the difference between, clever and wise. I like clever. I like to be perceived as, thought of, experienced as clever. Clever can be a lot of fun. It can appeal to the intellect. It can even be quite satisfying to be clever. I feel as I do this, I am surrounded by technology that could at least partly be attributed to the work of clever people. And you know, socially, I found that people often like you if you're clever, as long as you're not too smug about it. Wise is a much harder sell. My favorite definition of wisdom, as some of you will know, is wisdom is skill for living. Wisdom, it seems to me, is quite a bit more complex than cleverness, at least when it comes to how to live it out. But cleverness sometimes feels like it accounts for how we got ourselves into the spot we're in better than wisdom does. We might have gotten ourselves here by being clever, but not wise. At least when it comes to the ways that we are presently thinking about and dealing with and engaging with an idea like morality, or what ought to be compared to what is. Now, very short, I promise you, very short diversion here into a contemporary history of contemporary moral philosophy. That sounds like it could get crazy really fast. It's like two paragraphs. So like I said, stay with me. This does plug in. So 50 years ago, we're not going to back this up very far because many of the ways we approach thinking about these things as a society right now have been deeply influenced by very near field sort of thinking. So 50 years ago, A.J. Ayer, very influential thinker and writer about all of this, argued that moral judgments, because they are not verifiable, are meaningless. Ayer called them mere expressions of emotion. I was writing that down and I was just thinking, I can't help but wonder what Ayer would have thought of the exploration we were doing a couple of weeks ago, where we were talking about the contemporary understanding that the growing field of affirming data that says that we are emotional beings first and not rational beings first. Ayer would have started with the idea that we are rational beings almost period. We have emotions, but they're mere emotions. Anyway, Ayer's argument was that because you can't verify a moral judgment, it's meaningless. And Ayer wasn't the only person taking that kind of a position at that point in the conversation. There was lots of that kind of going on, very prevalent that period. And From that same period of thought in moral philosophy came the idea that ethics is just a matter of inventing right and wrong, which mean that morality is either subjective or relative, but it's never absolute. And since there's no way to finally verify that something is objectively true, the ideas of right and wrong are just not useful. So there's that pragmatism. Now, that's interesting. It's impacting. We are all living in a world that was deeply influenced by those thinkers and thinkers of along those same lines. But even at the height of those ideas, not everyone in the realm of moral philosophy thought that these ideas were leading somewhere good. For example, Alasdair MacIntyre, in his landmark 1981 book entitled After Virtue, made this observation. He wrote, "We continue to use moral language even though we have largely, if not entirely, lost our comprehension, both theoretical and practical, of morality." And that book is in third printing. I could be wrong about that, but it's gotten some traction, which is interesting. And there are others, and again, we're not going to get into it, but there were others who offered the perspective that although there is something observably valid about the sort of concepts that Ayers was championing, those concepts don't take into account ancient wisdom traditions of many kinds, including one that maybe many of us would be more familiar with by our own histories, including the ancient wisdom tradition of Judaism, from which Christianity springs, that go all the way back in the texts to Abram being told to teach his children the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just. What's right? What's the right thing to do? What's the just thing to do? What does justice look like here? Profoundly important moral questions. Ancient system in which they sit. And those kind of concepts would, for example, be on a bit of a collision course. So concepts like Ayers and the like were moving forward. Those concepts would be on a bit of a collision course with many aspects, for example, of indigenous teaching and traditions, also ancient ways of knowing and ancient ways of engaging with questions of what ought to be versus what is. Because those concepts, as I understand them, at a great distance, but even at that distance, it strikes me that they are grounded in notions of creator and the wisdom of elders being carried forward from person to person in community and the wisdom of community collectively. Those are all ways of knowing what ought to be that don't fit well with the dismissal of morality as a category. They just don't work that great with the idea that if this can't be measured and handled objectively and rationally, it's invalid. Those are a little bit oil and watery, those two ideas. So you might recall that last week I touched on Jesus' teaching about loving our enemies, a difficult teaching any way you look at it. Some people have said that teaching is unique to the teachings of Jesus and that it is the teaching that separates Christianity from all the religions that preceded it. I don't think it's that hard to see how that's a perspective that could be used to argue that Christianity is superior to all the religions that preceded it. Not the argument I'm making here, in case you missed it. And in case you missed it, let me just take it a little bit further. That idea doesn't hold up very well under examination because this concept that we should love our enemies is way older than the teachings of Jesus. There are a number of historic precedents. There's a Babylonian text called the Councils of Wisdom, which says, "Do not return evil to the man who disputes with you. Requite with kindness your evildoer. Smile on your adversary." And there's also an Egyptian text called the Instruction of Amenemope, which says this. And it's a translation, I know that, of course, but even in translation, I was very drawn to the poetics of this. Listen to that. I mean, remember, Egyptian, the Nile, barges, okay? Remember that the things we make in context. Listen to the opening two lines of this. "Row," as in paddle, "row that we may ferry the evil man away. For we will not act according to his evil nature. Lift him up, give him your hand, and leave him in the hands of God. Fill his gut with your own food, that he may be sated and ashamed. Interesting, hey? And the book of Proverbs, which again is a collection of very old, in many cases very old wisdom sayings, far predating the teachings of Jesus, but one would expect informing the teaching of Jesus as a Jewish rabbi. The book of Proverbs says this: if your enemies are hungry, give them bread to eat. And if they are thirsty, give them water to drink. Now, here's a question. Why would the wise ones of history point us in this direction? And why would those pointings still have some resonance today? Why are we still even bothering to wrestle with them? You could argue if they feel like they have some resonance, but they don't feel workable, for example. Can we attribute all of that longevity of those ideas simply to the determination of formal religions to perpetuate their own history, their own ideas, or might there be something, let's say, bigger going on? If we examine our own lives, even a little bit, then we are going to know that practicing wisdom that aims us at a higher or wider common good is complex, and it doesn't make certain a pleasant outcome. It doesn't always look or sound the same for everyone, that common good, and it could go completely sideways. You know, Proverbs, I enjoy Proverbs and I enjoy Psalms, and I must say, quite frankly, that there are many parts of the Bible that it is difficult for me to enjoy and engage with in ways that feel life-giving at this point, partly because I'm, you know, in the thick of the process of peeling back ways in which I feel like those sacred texts were really abused in my own life experience. And so learning to find ways to come back to them with different perspectives is, I'm going to say, the journey of a lifetime. But there are two sort of chunks that I have continued to enjoy throughout that process. One is Proverbs, because it feels like it's just so full of the kind of ancient wisdom that I appreciate and that I can lay alongside the wisdom of other traditions without feeling like I have to climb over this "my wisdom is better than your wisdom" barrier. And so I appreciate that. And Psalms I enjoy because I enjoy poetry and songs. And these are song lyrics and poems, many of them. And so they have that invitational ambiguity about them that I talked about a couple weeks ago. Anyway, Proverbs has some great examples of the ways in which this stuff doesn't behave in a super precise, linear, predictable kind of way. So for example, there's lots of examples we could give of this, but the classic one is when you're dealing with a fool, there's this pair of Proverbs, I don't even have chapter and verse written down here, but they just sort of ride around with me, where the first proverb says, when you're dealing with a fool, never do this. Never get in their face. It doesn't work. The very next proverb in the collection says, when you're dealing with a fool, always get in their face and correct them, because if you don't, they're going to just keep being an idiot. You know, these are paraphrases, obviously. The point in this case is that one says do this and the other one says do that. And they're side by side in a collection of wisdom. And this is the way wisdom operates, right? This is the nature of wisdom. It's not rational first. It's not irrational. We're not looking for polarization here. This is about the complexity of life and the complexity of engaging with life in wise ways. It's not always going to look the same, situation by situation, person by person, moment in history by moment in history. Life is complicated. A wisely lived life is complicated. And the wise ones know this, and they don't shy away from it. And if we are working to be wise, we would be well served to work hard to remember this. A life oriented to the common good, a moral life, that is, a life in which moral considerations are conscious and guiding ones, is complicated. It's not a life that always dictates the same perspectives and choices. It's bigger. It's more multifaceted than that. And wisdom always has a context. It has a community. It has a history. It has relationships. It has individual experiences in which it is enacted. and which deeply inform the various shapes that it takes. And maybe that complexity is there to remind us that what we're after when we seek the common good, when we look for some bigger story, for some bigger idea in which to stand while we engage with the complexity of life, maybe that complexity is there to remind us that when we do that, in the final event, we are doing something that both involves us and our personal perspectives and experiences, and also touches on realms that are well beyond our grasp. And they're not just realms that are beyond our grasp because they're beyond our personal experience or beyond our sort of small societal, near societal experience. They're beyond our grasp because they are beyond the grasp of humanity. They're beyond the grasp of the collective. Doesn't mean we don't grasp for them. It doesn't mean we don't reach toward them. Of course we do. We can't seem to help ourselves. But in the end, when we practice wisdom, when we try to live a wise life, one of the things that that life points us toward is this acknowledgement that one of the things that's fundamental to being wise is knowing that whatever we do in realms that reach beyond the things we can grasp. This is, I'm going to say, common to all of us as humans. To seek the common good, I would say, is to be willing to do what we can and to be open to mystery. To be open to the limits of what we can know and do, and to be open to ways of pressing into that mystery, including learning from those that don't believe as I do or as we do, if we're part of a collective that shares a belief. It might even be to seek something other than what we would typically think of or name the common good. That idea, those words around that idea, has its own history. And there may be wisdom to be received from well beyond the traditions that gave us that language and those ways of thinking about what is versus what ought to be or what could be. That's where we're going to pick it up next week. I want to offer us an examination of a picture, of a metaphor for the world that we live in and make, and how it is versus how it ought to be or could be, that is different than common ground. And just by way of keeping our imaginations lively and engaged with this stuff. So, next week. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening if you joined us by podcast for this one. Thanks for being part of a community that is willing to stay in existence to make room to explore what we believe. I believe in this deeply, and am so delighted to be part of a community that shares that commitment and that journey. It's good. It's good. Peace, y'all. And I'll see some of you in the Zoom hang at 1:00. All right. Bye for now.